You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm David Downs, California Bureau Chief for Leafly.com. I'm really excited to be here. You could be eating barbecue right now, but you're not. You're listening to us, and I really appreciate your time. We're really excited to get into this panel because we got Troy Date in front of us. I've been on the cannabis beat for 9 years now. I've written for Wired, Rolling Stone, Scientific American. I'm the former San Francisco Chronicle cannabis editor, and now I'm the California editor at Leafly.com. And the entire time I've been working in the field, I've been reporting on Troy and seeing his developments over the years. And so we're at this featured session, Cannabis from Fringe Issue to Big Industry. And we're going to do a 45-minute Q&A biographical chat with Dayton, Troy. And you guys can participate, too, by sending questions in through slido.com, hashtag South by Southwest. And you can vote on those questions, and we'll make sure to spend 15 minutes at the end answering them. Just as a real brief introduction, Troy Dayton's the founder of the ArcView Group, and since 2011, ArcView's got more than 1,500 members, and this is an angel investment network. So Troy's group has put more money into more cannabis businesses that were started by legacy operators than maybe anyone before. ArcView Group's invested about $240 million through its angels into over 200 companies. Dayton regularly tops magazines' most influential lists. He's the chair of the Marijuana Policy Project, which is changing cannabis laws nationwide as we speak. He's the co-founder of the Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP. If you're in school right now, you should get to your SSDP chapter and help them out, because there's a lot of work to do. Troy's also the founding member of the National Cannabis Industry Association, one of the first of its kind, and the ArcView Group helped create the first cannabis business accelerator for companies that were ready to take off, as well as solved the issue of insurance in terms of creating some of the first cannabis insurance companies. You know, Dayton has told me that he likes to compare himself, like call himself like the Forrest Gump of legalization, because he's had a front row seat to all these sort of pivotal moments in social history. But to me, his story reads much more like an Adam McKay movie, like Vice or The Big Short, in that this guy got up every day and did his job and did Troy, but in the process, it had all these outsized effects on society and the world that we all interact with. It's this mix of doing stuff in offices and protests and raids in the streets and the world literally changing, and it's an amazing story. So let's get started. Please welcome someone who's had a front row seat to this entire social, political, and economic revolution, Troy Dayton.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
I wanted to start with the news. I don't want anybody walking out of this thing, and I think we'll loop back and then finish by closing it together. ArcView is growing from just an angel investor network to working with the biggest deals potentially in cannabis. And I wanted to start there, like in telling these people who have a lot of interest, what's happening in cannabis investment in the cannabis investment space? How are the dynamics changing? You were telling me that the amount of money we're talking about these days is bigger than any of your guys' deals put together before.
Yeah, it's, you know, our minds are so incremental, but business and movements can be very exponential. And I think we're seeing something like that right now. To give you a sense, last year, our latest market predictions showed that last year we did about $12.8 billion in retail legal sales in the entire world of cannabis. But last year, there was over $13 billion invested into cannabis companies. So there was more money invested into cannabis companies than there was cannabis bought. But the year before that was 4x less. It was like less than about $3 billion. So in 1 year, a 400% increase in the amount of capital invested. This is a massive phase change and also a very important moment for the soul of the cannabis industry, the future of advocacy in the US and worldwide, as these are tectonic shifts that are happening very, very fast.
You said that you were bailing buckets full of water and here comes the tsunami.
Right, yes, yes.
Walk me through some of those deals. Like, Flocana just raised $135 million in California.
Yeah, that's the largest private deal in the cannabis space. And that's actually one of the real high points, I think. How can I say this delicately?
Don't say it delicately. We're trying to make news here.
I saw an Onion article today that said something like, "Worst, all that's wrong with corporate America just got all that's wrong with corporate America just got a promotion," right? which I think that seeing some of the companies that have been super, super successful in this space makes my stomach turn. Because when we think about, you know, what we originally started to work on and see, you know, people who are really greedy or who lie, cheat, and steal get to the top is kind of unfortunate. And I think the Flow Kana example is a really great standout there, because I think Flow Kana's got this incredible business model that is about lifting up the cultivators in places, small cultivators, which are really at risk right now in this shift, and figuring out a way to do well by doing good. And so I wouldn't say it's easy to make a lot of money, but in a marketplace that's growing at a 30% compound annual growth rate, if you've got access to a lot of capital, yeah, at this phase, it actually is not that hard to make a lot of money. But the real question is, I'm most interested in those stories where there's a lot of opportunity to make money by solving some of the biggest problems that we face from a political and economic standpoint. And I think that's a great example.
Did you imagine we'd be here with a 300% increase in capital flows into cannabis in 2018 when you got accepted to the American University in 1995?
Interesting, yeah. So... yes and no. Yeah, at that point I did, because I was 18 and I thought, oh my God, as soon as people realize that cannabis prohibition is bullshit, they're going, it's going to be a few years. We're just going to end this, right? But of course I was realized that that wasn't going to be the case at some point. And so then I got into the mindset of, okay, maybe this is going to be a longer road than I thought. But no, it's now been a surprise at how fast it's moved once, you know, because we've been pushing this up the hill for so long, and now we're, you know, chasing it down the hill.
You were born and raised in New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and tell me about going to school at American University in the late 90s, because this ended up being a really auspicious time for you and the movement, and it set the trajectory for your life.
Yeah. Let me set the stage a little bit. 1995, there had been no positive law changes on cannabis since the 70s when Normal had passed a few decrim laws around the country. We were still in the Ronald Reagan, Just Say No, Len Bias, mandatory minimum, drug war, drugs bad, okay, kind of world. And
I was in DARE that year.
Yes.
Shout out to DARE.
And so in 1995, nothing positive had been done. And the idea of medical cannabis was kind of an inkling. It was AIDS activists in the Bay Area of California who were really pioneering this and giving cannabis to AIDS patients as a form of civil disobedience, super radical activists. And that's what that's the backdrop that I got involved in. And at that point, you know, there was no, the Marijuana Policy Project was just getting started that year. And I got to be their first like volunteer and, you know, licked the envelopes for the first member mailing that they sent in 1995. And, you know, this is pre-internet, really. I mean, you know, there was, and so advocates weren't connected. There was really nothing to go on. Public opinion was about 24% public support. And
today it's at 61.
Yeah, and we're at 61% now. But I think it's interesting to look back too on getting involved, right?
Because, what was your first memorable activist action that you will have forever?
Yeah, so the first action was Barry McCaffrey was the drug czar at the time.
I haven't heard that name in so long.
He was retired general, 5-star general in charge of the drug war. Who's
since admitted defeat.
Sorry. Yes, recently he admitted defeat in this. He was threatening to arrest doctors and patients who said they were going to recommend medical cannabis to people in California because California and Arizona were on the ballot at that point. It was 1996. They were on the ballot, and we did a protest of McCaffrey, and we were on C-SPAN. So the very first big thing that we did got on national television on C-SPAN, and so I was hooked. You know, it was sort of like, oh wow, I can make a difference.
You had good visuals though. You did some agitprop. What did you do?
Yeah, so there was this during the Vietnam War, there was a famous protest that you'll see when you look back at Vietnam War stuff, and it happened at Ward Circle in D.C., where they put a cape on the back of the statue that said, "How many more?"
I think we've all seen that image of how many more.
Yeah, and so we put one on that said, "Stop arresting patients," and a bunch of us gathered out front there, and it was Eric Sterling who was he was one of the people who wrote a lot of the mandatory minimum drug sentencing laws, and then had a case of consciousness where he was like, "This is bad," and then devoted the rest of his life to changing it. We all gathered to take a picture around this statue, and Eric Sterling popped out and started orating to the group and talking about the long history of advocacy and activism and civil disobedience that we were a part of and how important it was to really devote our lives to this kind of work to free people. And I remember in that moment, it kind of crystallizing for me, oh wait, this is something that I could really focus my energy and my life on. And that was really the beginning of this, as a focal point.
You call yourself a credible rebel, someone who saw the cannabis issue and said, "This is stupid and wrong. I'm going to work on it." Where does that come from? What were your parents like? What was your childhood like? Was there anything there that was going to make you rebel against their traditionalism, or were they also activists in hand?
I don't know where I came from, but I've just always been drawn to things whereby where something's misunderstood. And by virtue of helping people understand it, you could really change something. And, now we look at cannabis and that's not the credible rebel thing, right? I mean, it's now something that's really, well supported. But at the time it was just, it seemed so rebellious on the surface. And yet I felt totally comfortable talking to my grandmother about it. I felt totally comfortable talking to anybody about it because I could just sense that it was misunderstood and that if once it was understood, we would change it. And I've done some of those things. I spent 3 years in 2003 to 2006 working with religious leaders on this topic. Now, I didn't grow up religious or anything, but I thought, well, hey, if we're going to win, we need to have the moral leaders of our country supporting it. And so I was going literally door to door in Nevada to religious leaders of all stripes, asking them to come on and support a legalization initiative that was happening there. That's what I mean by sort of credible rebel stuff, like really getting in the lion's den in doing that. Another one was a couple years ago, getting invited to speak at a Bank of America conference. Here I'm sitting there. And I'm a little more comfortable in those spaces now, but about 3 or 4 years ago, it was a little different. And I'm sitting there and there's all the people from the biggest banks in the world just trying to figure out how to get in on the cannabis sector. Huh. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, I basically, told them, well, for now, you can't really do it. You can't really do anything. Sorry.
If you want to come be a criminal, come on over.
But But yeah, it's been fun to see this really shift so much over the time.
What do you feel like have been the highlights of your activist resume when you look back on the various campaigns that you've been part of? What are going to be the stripes on your shoulder?
Well, it's really about the things that I think have maybe made the most impact that I've gotten a chance to be part of in some way. I mean, certainly I consider my, you know, no matter what happens with ArcView, no matter what happens with any of this stuff, I consider the greatest achievement to be Students for Sensible Drug Policy. What an incredible organization. They have, you know, what started in a stoned in a basement dreaming about what a real movement, student movement would look like, dreaming of what SSDP would be, and now seeing what it's become, not just in terms of the impact that they're making on a lot of laws around the world, but also in the leadership development that's happening for these students. And so many of the cannabis companies today are now filled with SSDP graduates.
There's like a mafia. It's unbelievable. SSDP mob. And if you're
how many out here SSDPers? Gosh. Oh, we got one.
Yeah, Shailene's a big one. You know.
Yeah. So that I think is really I think had the most of a lever on what's changed.
What do you think was your hardest political lift? Something that you worked on that can't believe you actually passed, or that something that you know you were part of that you can't believe actually passed.
Yeah, well, one was my first paid gig was being the volunteer coordinator for a campaign to have medical cannabis in Washington, D.C. in 1998. It passed by, I believe, 80%. Like, and this is, now, wow. Now that makes sense, right? Now you think, you know, those kind of numbers make sense now, but in 1998, not so much. But then what happened was they blocked it. The Congress blocked it and said, nope, you can't implement it. You said, because Congress controls DC. And I just remember feeling this sense of like, really? And I was like 20 at the time, right? And I'm thinking, this is what the world is. You fight for something, you pass it overwhelmingly, and then they just stop it.
Yeah.
Well, the great poetic justice there is that the guy who stopped that, Bob Barr, later, after he retired, had a change of heart on cannabis and ultimately was a lobbyist that was helping to pass medical cannabis. And so some people look at that, and I hear the groans, right? Some people look at that and think that's bad because, you know, here's somebody who was an opponent when they had the power. Now they don't have the power. They must just want the money. That may be at play, okay? However, the only way we're ever going to win this and the only way when the history books are written, the way that we win is by making our tent bigger and bigger and bigger. And in order to do that, you have to take former enemies and make them allies. We cannot win without making former enemies allies. And so whenever anybody groans when we've, yeah.
Right. Need everybody.
And, you know, and
especially
I'm not, and I don't, and you know, I really don't care why, right? What I care about is what people are actually doing, the effect of their actions. And I think that may be an appropriate segue into, you know, when we started ArcView, we started it with the idea that if we were going to end marijuana prohibition, that in order to do that, we needed to have a credible, profitable, and politically engaged cannabis industry. And that in order to do that, that meant that in order to win, we needed to spark up the engines of capitalism. We needed to spark up the engines of self-interest so that more people would get interested in changing the laws because it had some impact on their bottom line to do so. You know, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game kind of thing, right? Like, that's the world we live in. And so we set out to build an engine in the cannabis sector that would create the space whereby people would be motivated to free people, even if they didn't initially start out caring about that.
Where does any business acumen or business desire come from? You know, you've said, how does a credible rebel end up helping, quote, the rich get richer? Where does this business experience come from? You were in the dot-com video boom number one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I really got hooked by this. You know, cannabis wasn't particularly addictive to me, but cannabis legalization was. I was just, I loved being able to make these changes in the world. But throughout it, I always had this sort of entrepreneurial bent. And so, you know, in late 90s, I helped start a digital video media company that we raised a bunch of money. It was basically a cross between, you know, Facebook and YouTube. It was about digital video driven online communities. We were a little too early, but I got pulled out of cannabis in drug policy for a year or so in order to do that. And then I went back.
Your first fundraise?
Yes. Yeah. And then I got pulled back to doing advocacy and then pulled back to start a renewable energy company with some friends in the early 2000s. And I just kept getting pulled back into advocacy and basically having these moments where, oh my God, I thought, you know, we were all going to be billionaires on paper. You know, it was like these moments where you're like part of these booms. But then I'm like, but my heart is really about changing the laws. And so I basically gave up these other booms because I really felt like this was my calling. But it wasn't until about 2009 that it ever even crossed my mind that my work to just change the world and sort of have a vow of poverty practically would lead to the next big business boom. Like, you gotta believe me here that like none of the people who are working on changing these laws for the last 30 years even thought that didn't even cross our minds that there would be like this industry and an opportunity to make money until at least, maybe I was a year or two late to the game, but like 2007, 2008, 2009, really where that began. And so to be sitting here where literally it's like the top trending topic on CNBC and on Vice and all these things, and it's just like, it's kind of mind-boggling. But in order, for the purpose of advocacy, it was really important to be part of building that and helping to create that engine.
What were some of the early wins and losses of ArcView? Take me to those early days.
Yeah, so in 2009, I sat down with Steve D'Angelo and
Harborside Health Center founder, yeah. Biggest dispensary in California, battled the feds and beat them on a forfeiture charge. Quite the rebel.
Yeah, he's here too. I think he's speaking.
I think he might have spoke.
Oh, he already spoke. Whoops. Tomorrow.
See him tomorrow, everybody.
So we thought that, you know, I was the lead fundraiser for the Marijuana Policy Project at the time, and I was meeting with a lot of high net worth people who made their money in other things and were donating to this just because they cared, and then also raising money from dispensary operators and people who were committing civil disobedience, who were donating because they didn't want to go to jail. And we saw this opportunity that said, hey, if our hypothesis is correct, that to end this, we're going to need to build a profitable, politically engaged, and responsible cannabis industry, then how do we do that? And so the idea was, you know, he was seeing all these people that had great ideas that he couldn't figure out how to, you know, what to do with. And I was meeting all these people with all this money who wanted to put money into this, but didn't really know the first thing about the cannabis industry and were making really dumb decisions. And so we decided to pair up and Steve became our, you know, kind of gave us our seed money, and I went off and started trying to figure out what kind of business to do to be able to affect this kind of change and build something sustainable. And so So we started doing that, and we played around with a couple different business models. And then in 2011, November of 2011, we had our first ArcView meeting with about a dozen investors and two different companies, one of which, interestingly, was MJ Freeway, which, of course, later raised a lot of money through our group and then is now, you know, going through this big merger.
Major tech company.
So that was then. But then in the middle of all of that, right after we started this and we thought we were really gung-ho, in 2010, Obama changed his mind. Obama was in favor of medical cannabis and then decided that he was going to kind of flip-flop on it, right?
He was elected in 2008, said he'd do hands-off medical. Medical exploded in California. The midterms happened in 2010. Yep. He felt like he needed to dial it back, and so they called for a medical crackdown, and it was this huge brushback pitch, and the number one victim was investment, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was impossible to get investors in the room after that, right? I mean, nowadays, if that had happened, which it did with Sessions, the industry was big enough at the time that they were like, yeah, whatever. but at the time, that wasn't the case, and so... You know, this was a tough time. I mean, 2011, 2013 was like really, really tough because we couldn't really do what we had set out to do. And the money had dried up. We weren't able to raise the money.
Prop 19 lost.
Prop 19 lost.
That was on the ballot back then from Richard Lee here in California. And it failed. And it was seen as a referendum on the movement.
Exactly. And so we wound up, I mean, I was living in my car for about 6 to 8 months on people's couches and in my car because we didn't have the money to do this work. And it was kind of ironic because I was working with all these like...
You had an angel investor network and you were homeless.
Yes. Yes.
That's quite the moxie.
I know. Well, it gets even stranger because in November of 2012, you might remember that was the shot heard around the world when Colorado and Washington ended cannabis prohibition, and the everything changed, right? So here we were, like barely making it, almost thinking of closing ArcView down. Steve was always the stalwart, always held that candle for no, this plant's going to change the world,
and he never wavered,
not a minute. And
you
so
were in a carport.
Yes, I was living in a carport. It was crazy. And so that changed, that happened, the legalization in Colorado. And then 3 months later, in March of 2013, ArcView was the focal point of the first cover story by a major business magazine on the cannabis sector. So we were on the cover of Fortune magazine. Now, by that point, I had an apartment. But it was a tiny apartment in the back of somebody else's house. And it was also our offices. So, you know, there were like four people that were working at ArcView. We each had each side of the table was our desk. And here we were on the cover of the largest wealth magazine in the world at that time.
It's all mirage, people.
you know, trying to make us figure out how we could look a little bit bigger, you know? And so that's kind of the beginning of where it started to grow, where all of a sudden people thought we were geniuses, right? And then it started to really grow from there.
You told me that you had a frontline first-person encounter with this dynamic where something seems hopeless,
yeah,
and then overnight, everyone starts to act like it's inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, for most of my life, people would laugh at me when I told them what I did, right? I'd say, oh, I worked to legalize a cannabis, and they would laugh, be like, oh, good luck with that. Let me tell you why that's not going to happen, right? And they would list all of these reasons why that wasn't going to happen. And then literally, almost overnight, sometime between November of 2012 and the end of 2013 is like a few month span, all of a sudden, all the same people, the conventional wisdom was that it would, previous to that, was it was hopeless. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, it's inevitable. And there's something really in common between hopelessness and inevitableness. You know what that is? It means you don't have to do shit, right?
Oh.
Because if it's inevitable, if it's hopeless, why do anything? If it's inevitable, why do anything? Well, I think it's important to remember, not just with this issue, but all issues and all things we really care about, that nothing's ever hopeless. And because it takes the people who believe it's not to keep doing the work to have that sense of responsibility. And it's also not really inevitable either, right? It wasn't inevitable after 2013 either. It took people who believed that it was possible but not inevitable to put the money up, to spend the time, to put the energy into work, to take the civil disobedience of building a company in this space and putting your name and your face out there in a way that would make an impact on this. And I do think that we are now in somewhat of an inevitable place.
But.
I don't think the question now is if cannabis will be legal. It's a question of when and how, and more importantly, who benefits. And you might have this sense of, oh, it's inevitable. The Altrias and the constellations of the world are just going to take this thing over, and they're just going to make it for themselves and
not even Fortune 100 companies, like, right. Fortune 10 companies.
Fortune 10 companies are going to own the, that's sort of part of the same conventional wisdom, which is ultimately birthed in people's desire not to want to do shit, right? I don't think that that's true. I think that we do have an opportunity to be part of figuring out how we're going to change these laws in each of the states, how we're going to do it that maximizes how we free the most people, how we give access to people who've been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs, and still be creating a new kind of industry. I think there's a real opportunity for that. But it's getting harder. It's getting harder. But I still think at the end of the day, it's shocking. And I'm the chair of the board of the Marijuana Policy Project. And while all of this is happening right now, with all this money being made, all these multi-billion dollar deals, it's harder than ever to raise money for this work in the States. But there's an old saying, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, okay? And so if you're somebody who cares about ending marijuana prohibition fairly, now's the moment. Now's the moment to whip out the checkbooks, to utilize your influence, to build businesses that build changing the laws and into your business models. Now is the time to make your voice heard about how we're going to change these laws, because we're looking at maybe as much as 15 more states in the next 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
Changing their laws if we have the support and if we have the firepower behind us to make sure that we can change these laws fairly. And I think that's our big opportunity going forward. And remember, I think it's also important to remember too, especially if you live in a state where legalization is already the case, it's easy to be like, to take for granted the freedom that you have. But it's important to remember that even still today, more than 95% of the world still lives in a place where they wake up in fear of their government for this plant. We got the whole world still needs to end cannabis prohibition, right? The whole world. So we got a lot more work to do. And this isn't just this is not just a cannabis industry. Until there's not a single adult punished for this plant anywhere in the world, we are still a movement. That's what makes us different than the dot-com boom. That's what makes us different than the renewable energy boom. It's what makes us different than the social networking boom, right? When people talk about the cannabis space, right? If they're also not talking about the fact that these two things will forever be intertwined, because as long as there are people going to jail for paying their bills with cannabis, we shouldn't have states and governments paying their bills with cannabis. And so anybody who's in this industry, and I sit down with a lot of them, and I'm often very, very shocked to hear people who run companies that have $10 million to $50 million a year in annual revenue, or who just raised $50 million or $100 million.
People you made $5 million.
Right. You know, I sit down and I say, well, okay, cool. Well, what's your budget for changing more of the laws to open up new markets, right? And they're like, well, you know, I mean, right now we're paying for this and for that, and we got to worry about our local regulations.
Polo
and
coach.
All of this stuff. And I'm just like, really? You're kidding me. You rode the backs of all the people who have fought for this, and the very thing that you're trying to make money on, people are going to jail for? Not to mention half of them are your future customers. I mean, this just makes sense, right? The good news is we're starting to get through. I think more and more companies are getting on board, contributing to the cause. And there's some good news too, in terms of some of these bigger players getting involved. The really, really big players are actually aligned with all of us here and wanting to have a mostly open market and not a concentrated, restricted market. So we're in a bit of a unique situation at the moment where, you know, a lot of the big multi-state operators who focus on, who want really restricted licensing, so there's only like 20.
They want little cartels, little oligopolies.
Yeah, these little oligopolies in different states. As brands get bigger, they don't care about that. They want more. They want more access points. They want lower prices. They want same thing with the big companies. You know, these big companies that are coming in. They want broader access as well. So there's not like good guys and bad guys in this world. In this realm, there's there's different people who will be allies with you on certain things and not allies in you on other things. But one of the things I'm really committed to, and one of the things I could use your help with, is making this an inhospitable environment for people who want uber restricted markets and who aren't donating to change the laws.
Name and shame.
Yeah.
Let's bring it all together and talk about a path forward for the movement and for you, Troy. You started out on this mission to make capitalism the engine of reform. You kind of succeeded. Have you ever thought, like, gosh, what hath I wrought? I didn't know there's other reformers here, too, who've been working on this for a generation. And you must ask yourself, Amanda, shout out to Amanda Ryman, everybody. Yeah. What hath I wrought some days? And what do you tell yourself?
Yeah, actually, Amanda, this is one of me and Amanda's favorite pastimes.
You guys have a little Google Hangout, you do?
You know, it's on the one hand, I think we've succeeded in a lot of ways, and on the other hand, I never expected that we would have $13 billion invested in the cannabis sector and have a hard time funding the work to get another state legalized that we know we can do that might only cost like $500,000 to change a state law that opens up a $1 billion market. Like,
crazy.
Are you kidding me? Okay. And here's the thing. I mean, I didn't get into this to make rich people richer and to help people sell more weed. Okay. I'm fine with those two things as long as we are achieving these other goals. And so, you know, there are some days I wake up and think, ugh, really? But there are other days. And there are some really great examples of companies that are contributing majorly to the cause. There's some really great examples of businesses that are building, that are doing this. And you know, when I go to cannabis conferences, people still tell me all the time, not just my own, but others' conferences as well, that there's a different energy in the air, that the fact that this plant brings people together the way it does, and the fact that this was born out of a social movement, and because people, no one sits on their deathbed and thinks, wow, I wish I made more money, but they often think, about meaning, and because being in this industry has meaning for people, that there's a different energy in the air, and that we are actually changing the way business is done, and it is impacting how business becomes. So I think, you know, I can kind of share, you know, both sides of it. And that actually brings up an interesting point too, which is that one of the most common things that I see a lot of newer businesses doing that I really want to caution them against is everybody's talking about like professionalizing the industry.
Yeah.
But professionalizing sometimes is about, is on the good side of professionalizing, yes, we want to be better capitalized, we want top talent, we want to be borrowing best practices from lots of other industries, and we want to bring that up. But oftentimes, professionalizing is essentially code for race and class, right?
Marginalizing.
Yeah, basically throwing...
Stoners.
Throwing stoners under the bus. I don't know how many times I've seen people get up on stage and use a picture of a black man in dreads to point out what they're not doing. And then a picture of a white guy in a suit to show them what they are doing. Well, these are not so subtle indication, and it's just like, really? So I think we gotta not be throwing, I didn't fight for 30 years on this so that, well, 20 years. I did this so that people could be more themselves, so that there was more freedom, so people didn't feel like second-class citizens. And so I want to see the industry develop marketing and develop a conversation that's inclusive of the people that are in this space and the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying make the tent bigger, don't kick people out of the tent.
Exactly.
Even if it means Speaker Boehner might be in the tent.
Totally. I welcome Speaker Boehner, you know?
Should we welcome former enemies?
We should welcome former enemies, absolutely.
Should they have to do a mea culpa?
Hey, or? Speaker Boehner is out there meeting with the people that other people can't meet with and is helping them change their position on cannabis. God bless him.
I know Texas needs help.
Texas needs help.
You are not just... cannabis guy. You have omnivorous interests and you're smart and you read a lot. What's next for Troy? What if you had to walk away from all of this, what would you go do or what have you already started doing?
Well, I think a friend of mine posted something on Facebook and said, in six words or less, describe like your essence, like who you are, what your life is about. And I, you know, just on a whim quickly wrote, bringing people together for credible rebelliousness. Yeah. And one of the things I've loved doing the most, and part of what we do at ArcView, is that while cannabis is the thing that's ostensibly what we're doing, cannabis business, the thing that really wakes me up is creating community in a way that people really feel a sense of commitment to the group and that sense of community that really makes life exciting and worth living. And so it's about creating contexts for unusual levels of connection.
Okay.
And that's one of the things I feel like at at ArcView, a lot of people respond to. They're like, wow, I've just never met a group of people in business that's so collaborative, that's so, you know, more than just about business. And there are, so I love thinking about how to create those contexts.
Yeah.
And so whether that's in the cannabis industry or anywhere, I really love bringing groups of people together in unique ways for them to experience just some sense of transcendence and connection.
You, it strikes me that you've always been a, you've been a serial association builder.
Mm-hmm.
And the right to associate is something that is obviously enshrined in our Constitution, and it's like part of the American DNA, and it's one of the most powerful parts of the American experience is the right to freely associate. People don't even understand how limited that is around the
totally.
World. So stay tuned for that. You know, we're at the 15-minute mark,
and so we can
take some questions. I think they're coming in to Slido.com, and hashtag SXSW. We have the first question that's been voted up, and you can all vote on this like Reddit. Cannabis has been a criminal, racist issue, but now white corporate America is more accepting. What's your inclusive responsibility to help those jailed? And I think bigger picture is like, how do you live your values at ArcView?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think I addressed this a little bit, but I think, you know, part of it is really, you know, focusing on this and making sure that in our marketing, in our recruiting, that we really focus on trying to be as inclusive as possible, making sure we're not supporting laws that make it so people who have a past a criminal record in the space are unable to participate in it, making sure they have ample opportunity. California, I think, was really the first state that included that. I think it's about ending cannabis prohibition so that, you know, poor people and people of color are not disproportionately affected. And so those are some of the things that we can do. There's also the Minority Cannabis Business Association just came out with model equity legislation. I think this is really hard. It's there've been a number of attempts at it that haven't worked out exactly as planned, and so it's one thing to say you support equity. It's another thing to really make sure that those equity programs actually achieve their purposes. So I think that's really important. And so we're, you know, one of the things we did at ArcView to help with sort of inclusivity is we started this Women's Investor Network, which has really become a real powerhouse for women in our group and in our industry to gather together in a way that's powerful. And we are right now in talks with a number of different minority-focused groups in the cannabis sector to now focus a little more heavily on that aspect of underrepresented groups in the space. But I think the number one thing we can do is end cannabis prohibition and have less limited licensing going on, because when you do those two things, that has the biggest impact on creating access.
And that's been happening. California's Proposition 64 included expungement and retroactive mm-hmm. sentencing. It was the first time a legalization initiative had included those things. It threw open county jails to people sitting there for growing a pot plant and they couldn't afford bail. Millions are eligible for their records to be fixed.
Yeah.
And expungement's gone from being an afterthought of legalization to the table stakes in places
right.
like New Jersey and New York. So much so that it might slow down legalization
exactly.
at this point. And there's all these flavors of legalization on Capitol Hill that start with just states' rights on the conservative side all the way over to full-blown expungement on the more progressive side. And it seems clear to me that, like, if you want people out of jail, regardless of the color, get this done faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this is, brings up an interesting point, too, which is that the part of the difference having, you know, now being mostly on the business side and formerly being mostly on the advocacy side, there's this, activists are just never happy with anything, right? I mean, no matter what, you could have freed millions of people and it'd be like, okay, checkbox, but this thing is messed up, you know?
Oh, man.
But then in business, it's the total opposite. Things could be falling apart terribly in your business, and people come out there and they're like, everything's awesome. We just check out what we just did. Rah, rah, right? So I feel like I live in this like schizophrenic world. I don't know whether to celebrate or not be happy enough with what we've got. But I do think it's important for us all to take a moment to really be grateful to have been part of and to have been alive during a time where a social issue has gone from being like laughed about and considered totally impossible to having shifted in our lifetime in a way that has a real tangible benefit to millions and millions of people and eventually billions of people as the dominoes keep falling. And so, you know, if you've played a role in that, I thank you, and I think we should be celebrating as well as working to make additional changes.
Two questions are tied for votes. One's Europe, but we'll hold for that one. The one below it, I think everybody cares about. With Donald Trump being a conservator as he is, how do you imagine the next steps of legalization in the U.S.? What about the rest of the world? What's your read on the potential for progress in 2019 in D.C.?
Yeah. So Donald Trump.
You don't have to say his name.
Well, I think he's pro-cannabis, but more importantly, I think the political dynamics and the public opinion are such that this is going to be a no-brainer for him in about a year. he's already said that he'll support the states' rights stuff, and I think that, you know, the Democrats really, I mean, they missed their shot on this. I think the Democrats could have outflanked the Republicans super easily on this issue a few years ago, but they were wimps. And
they were doing healthcare and this and that.
Yeah, and the public opinion polling was there. They just didn't have it. They just didn't have the kind of guts to do it. And now I think they're at risk of having the Republicans outflank them on this issue. I mean, right now you've got every single Democratic presidential candidate that has announced being supportive of ending cannabis prohibition and leaving it up to the states. That's amazing. That's kind of amazing. But I think there's a real possibility that what slows this down is that this issue has become, you know, gone from the third rail of politics to the thing that people are fighting to get credit for
right
now.
And so
they may not want to get, like, you know, the Republicans may not, you know, the Democrats may not want to give the Republicans the win here, and the Republicans may not want to give the Democrats the win here. And that's why when I think about what's going to happen at the congressional level, it's important to remember that Congress is the last body to do everything. And even when there is vast agreement, it's really still hard to get anything done. And so I know people are talking about, oh, we're going to see major reform this year. I'm less optimistic. I do think we will see it in the next 2 to 3 years, that we will see major, major reform at the federal level. But it won't be that cannabis will be legal everywhere. It'll be a states' rights question. And I think that's most likely how it'll pan out.
Senator Cory
Gardner. Yep.
Floated the States Act that would allow states that pass legalization to exempt themselves from the Controlled Substances Act from the 70s, which is where all of our drug war comes from. And he's said that the president would sign that if he can get it to his desk. And now the Cannabis Trade Federation is pushing really hard on the States Act.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question. If you had to pick a flavor of the doable versus the dream, you know, where do you lie? I mean, there's stuff from Representative Blumenauer that's more expansive than what Senator Gardner has put forward. Mm-hmm. Do you even care to weigh in on?
I mean, I'm not an expert on the nuances of all of that. What I do know is that banking reform IRS 280E reform so that they're not overpaying on taxes. These are two areas that I think could get resolved very, very soon. And I think there's opportunity there. I also serve on the board of the National Cannabis Industry Association, which represents a few thousand businesses in the cannabis sector and has lobbyists on the Hill working on all of those issues to push them forward. And so now that the Democrats are in charge of the House, you know, we're really starting to get real hearings. We're likely to get real votes. We're likely to really see where people are. And I think, you know, I'm in favor of anything that's going to move the needle, with the exception of the fact that, well, we don't want a situation where, the only things that get passed are the things that benefit the big companies, while the rest are still subject to arrest and imprisonment. I think we do need to say, hey, you know, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to solve this problem, you got to solve this problem too. So I think there's some elements to that as well.
I feel like we've seen like an early play out of this with the farm bill, which sort of legalized hemp, industrial hemp. It's just rope, can't get you high. Kentucky and these places really want to grow it, these conservative places. And the farm bill says hemp's legalized, yeah, if you have a state license and a state rule and some federal rules and it's all above board. You can't just go plant hemp in the back of your field.
Right.
And certainly the people who are liable to get those licenses are going to be better capitalized.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I think you're right. And while we're talking about hemp, I mean, the real thing when we look at this industry going forward is, you know, there's just some surprises. Like, you know, not that the hemp bill was a surprise, but the way that people almost overnight are so excited about CBD and hemp, that's been a bit of a surprise. Everything's changing the game. I mean, they're like putting, you know, CBD in literally everything almost overnight. Like, how did they even get the packages made that fast? Right? Like, wow. I mean, things are moving so fast, and there are icebergs around every corner. And we need to make sure that we're navigating them well. And that's why we're going to need so much more of the talent. I mean, there's so much more money being spent now on recruiting top talent. And we're going to need it because there's a lot of big issues and problems to solve as we move forward in this.
Yeah, CBD versus the FDA, you know, and everything else. The top question, we got two more minutes, is how do you think the cannabis industry will develop in Europe? And what role will the Europeans play in all of this moving forward?
Yeah, well, we have an example of that getting underway right now in Germany. It's one thing that's really interesting is you've got a medical cannabis market in Germany, which is huge, where it's going to be competing with pharmaceuticals for the first time on any scale. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see, because at least so far, cannabis has always competed with pharmaceuticals where insurance pays for the pharmaceuticals but doesn't pay for cannabis, so the added cost of the pharmaceuticals is sort of hidden to the end consumer. And I think that's going to be really interesting. I think medical cannabis is already really sweeping across Europe. And I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see how that develops. I think there's a lot of really interesting opportunity there. They don't have any of the same knowledge we have. They're going to need all the people from here to help them in the beginning. And it's interesting for Canada. Canada's exporting to Europe. I mean, if you'd have told me 10 years ago that Canada was going to be the major exporter of cannabis and that they were going to be sending it to places in Europe, I'd have told you you were nuts. But it's just so funny how when, you know, I think of the cannabis industry like a kind of like a bonsai tree, right? It's like, you know, you create all these like weird constraints and like, but like life finds a way and it's just wild to see, like, you couldn't have written this if you tried. It's just bananas.
yeah, oh, right. Right. Yeah.
Not planned.
But, you know, maybe someone should try. The story you've told is historical in its sweep. You've gotten a chance to witness the arc of the moral universe bend in your lifetime, which so few people do. And I hope there is a chance for someone to write it up into a movie and everyone to know what it was like to live this a little bit. Everybody, please give a round of applause to Troy Dayton. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And get at him afterwards.